there are like two types of people. There's people who like hit a wall and they turn around and they go the other way, like Roomba, right? They're like Roomba people. They hit a wall. They're like, okay, I'm going to go find. There's a path in here somewhere. And then there are people who hit a wall and the first thing they do is they run really fast and throw their shoulder into it just to see, right? Like just to see, okay, does this wall actually, is it real? Can I just run through it, you know? And then the second thing they do is they, you know, try to look for a way over it. And there are times where the Roomba person gets through the maze faster, right? Like there's times where like not going through a wall is the right call. But people with a default run through the wall are way more likely to have the outsized outcome than people who go around. Cause like those people are looking for a path, right? And there's not much value creation in the path. Like that path is a path for a reason that someone has worn that path.
Thank you so much to Dula for being the early vehicle of the podcast. For entrepreneurs and founders just starting out, forming a US LLC, a bank account, managing taxes, compliance can be a daunting task. If you're a non-US resident or first-time founder who lacks the experience, knowledge to navigate the complex legal and financial landscape, it will be impossible for you to do all this. Dula is an automation platform that simplifies the process of forming a US LLC, setting up a US bank account, and handling taxes, compliance for startups and businesses all over the world. Dula's mission is to democratize access to the US market and empower entrepreneurs to focus on building their businesses without getting bogged down by bureaucracy. If you're building a company, there's no better option out there than Dula.com. Hey Garrett, how are you doing? Well?
Hey, doing well. How are you doing?
Try to do well. But before we get into anything else, who is Garrett? Who are you? Who is Garrett?
Oh, who am I? Yeah, well, work on Pipedream Labs during the day. Also work on Pipedream Labs during the night. So that's pretty much who I am. in between, I play with my son a little bit, and that's it.
If we like get into the main thing, sort of, I have a lot of deep tech people on, from Adam Draper to a lot of these folks on. Everyone has a different idea of what deep tech is. So what does deep tech mean to you?
I think Christian Kyle has a good description. It's like anything where the technical risk is more than the market risk. That's deep tech. I think it's like also like there's a component of it that the way I've always looked at it is like it's something that if you can achieve it, you have an inherently very deep moat, and has like a uncopyable component. That's like very, very tough to copy or replicate. But I think it's like, it's one of those nebulous things. I think people also like, you know, there's also so many terms for the same thing, you know, hard tech, deep tech, you know. But I think, yeah, it's something where like doing the thing is extremely hard. But once you do it, there's an inherent market baked in. And once you achieve it, you have a really deep moat. That's close enough, I think.
What's the technical risk at play, like you talk?
There's a part that's like operational risk, but other than that, it's pretty much all technical risk. It's like, okay, can we, you know, build this thing for, you know, and operate it for cheap enough, to make more money, than it costs to make the thing happen. You know, you never really know until you do it. So this stuff thing, like software, it's kind of baked in inherently, that if you, you know, if you build something people like, then we know, because you know, most of software is pretty much the same. You know that like, one, starting out, your margins are already fat, but then going forward, you're like, well, it would just, you know, we can make it even more efficient. But usually when you're doing something in deep tech, it's something pretty novel. So you don't really know if you'll be able to get the costs down far enough.
Deepak companies usually have a long time to get rolled out. How much of what you guys build versus how much of it is deployed? How much consistency is there?
I mean, like, you know, the robot we're working on right now is like version 16, so not a lot, you know, pretty low. I think it depends on like how tight your iteration cycles are. So if you're doing like, you know, we try to keep iteration cycles really, really tight. You know, shoot for 2 weeks, it ends up being, you know, 3-4 weeks usually. But if you're doing that, then you're trying, you know, you're trying a lot of things, and so making a lot of changes. So pretty low percentage, I think.
Should deep tech companies start in STEM, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think you have to. I think there's part of it where you have to, but I don't think, like, you don't have to. It's not so binary. You don't need to do, like, you don't have to be all the way stealth or, like, all the way, you know, build in public. I think you just, like, you choose the things you want to be public about. And you usually choose things that are really on the frontier, right? Like for us, that's like hyperlogistics, right? It's really on the frontier. We don't lose anything if anyone tries to compete with us there, right? Like that's good for us. Like let's all go towards that huge, big goal. The things that happen in the next 1 to 2 years, that is what someone could, we don't want competition there. And so we're more quiet about like the stuff that happens in the next 1 to 2 years, really public about the next 5 years. Plus, like everything in the next 5 years is where you attract, like, you know, your whole goal for not being in stealth is to attract talent and attract capital. And both of those things are powered by your 5 year plans, not your 2 year plans. So we call it iceberg stealth. You know, you just like you keep that little top of the iceberg above the water and you keep the rest of it down underneath.
Do you think the main goal will ever change as you develop it?
Yeah, 100%. I think so. Probably, I mean, it's unlikely. Like for us, you know, making hyperlogistics happen this decade, I think that goal is pretty unlikely to change. But how you get there changes, you know. It's super unlikely that changes. I think if you like pick a goal where like, if it's outcome-based, if you have an outcome-based goal, then it shouldn't change, but like how you get there should absolutely change. But if your goal is like, you know, we want to use taxis and make an app that uses taxis to get people around, that's probably a bad long-term goal because it traps you in using taxis. We want to make it as efficient as possible to move people around cities. That's a great goal. So Uber obviously went the second route and that allowed them to, you know, pivot into apps and gig drivers when, you know, Lyft did that and it was working and, you know, they still accomplished their goal. So yeah, you keep goals like as outcome based as possible. Indeed, if anything, it never changes unless you just completely do something totally different. But I can't think of many examples outside of like Slack where that's happened and worked.
With like long-term companies where you are like coming up 20-year plans, how does technical limitation within that period dictate what your main goal is?
It's not like you're talking about like if new capabilities come online while you're working on something.
Right.
That's the best.
Yeah.
That's great. I think it's all about your orientation to it, right? You can't fall in love with what you make. If you fall in love with what you make and new capabilities come online, then your brain's incentivized to look at that thing and find all the reasons why it's not going to work, right? Because you've sunk all this cost, like all this time and effort and energy into this tech stack, and then new tech stack comes online and you're like, well, you know, it will never work for, you know, this many reasons. I'm just going to continue on my text. I don't want to start over, right? I just want to keep going. As long as you're like, you know, you look at every new tech and you try to, you know, balance what you're working on currently and what you would do with that new stack, then it's great because like you can, you know, you are the best position possible to utilize it because you've already spent a lot of work on the industry and the customers. And as long as you can get over the cost of like having to start over, then it's great.
How do you not fall in love with them?
You got criticized it often and a lot. If you're not criticizing what, if you haven't vocalized criticism about what you're doing or talked about alternative path to like someone on the team in the last week, then you're building up like love of the tech, right? You've got to like, you get to a certain point where you've worked on something so long that like, you know what the flaws are, but you don't want to like say them out loud. You create these sacred cows. So I think you just have to, you got to talk crap about what you make with you, you know, you and the team. And I think you have to be like hyper aware of its flaws and vocalize those. That way people like, you know, that way for yourself and for others, it's like a very comfortable thing to do. And then I think also like, you know, if anyone's praising you for what you're doing, you can't listen to that. You have to assume they're probably wrong in the same way that you assume, like if someone is saying like, oh, you can't do this, that's impossible. They're also probably wrong. People saying like, oh, this is the future, this is obviously where it's going. This person's a genius. That person's also wrong. So you can't listen to them either. Cause that's where you build up like, oh, maybe I am great. Then it's like, well, you know, I've accepted all this external validation. And now if I change course, I lose all the external validation. So yeah, I think you just gotta, you know, try to stay really pessimistic and critical, and they'll help you make that call when you need to.
You didn't like maintain that balance, because a lot of time what happens is people praise you because you're doing something that is so quote unquote futuristic, but on the other hand, you have to look at it in the point of view that you sustain it. So how do you balance yourself out between handling all the overtly praise that's coming your way versus criticizing and being kind of pessimistic?
Yeah, I think you just gotta like, you just gotta keep like a really good balance mentally. I think like we have a lot of conviction on what the future looks like, and the future is, you know, autonomous delivery, fast, cheap autonomous delivery to you and autonomous delivery from you, and that's going to happen. If we die, that's going to happen. Like, there's nothing we can do to keep that from happening. What we can do is we can make it happen faster. And like, I don't think anyone else sees that. Like, I think there's people working in it who see it, but I don't think external people see it. I think what they see is like, oh, here's this like novel solution. That's cool, right? And that's really rad. And it is cool that people are working on that. And they want to vocalize, oh, I want to give appreciation for this person who's worked on this cool thing that like inspires me to go and look at other things differently. Which I do that for other people, right? Like I'm inspired by Ben and Tristan from Reflectorable, from Augustus, from Rainmaker. I think like the way they look at things, that really inspires me. And, you know, I'm going to tell them they're great and they shouldn't listen to me, because what I'm doing telling them they're great is what was wrong, right? Like they've inspired me by the way that they've looked at things. And I think that, oh, okay, this thing is like really, really great, but I don't have enough data or information or understanding of the industry to like make that assessment. In the same way that if I told them they were wrong, I don't have enough data or understanding to make that assessment. Like they're the only ones who can do that. So I think you got to like, you got to get really good at not listening to people saying you're wrong. And in the same way, you just have to get really good at not listening to people say you're right. And you kind of just need to like, be laser focused on, okay, what does the world look like in the future and how do we get there as fast as possible? That should be, you should have that same outlook. If people are all telling you you're stupid, if people are all telling you you're a genius, or if people aren't talking about you all, like all that external stuff, like shouldn't affect how you look at, okay, we're trying to get to this outcome. How do we get there as fast as possible? I think having a day one mentality, you know, one of Amazon's core tenets is they always say like the danger is that like if you ever get to day two where you're like, okay, well, we're doing this thing, like we just need to persist and like, you know, we're the biggest company in the world, so let's just keep doing what we're doing. But like having a day one mentality means like nothing you've done in the past matters. Like what do you do from today based on today's information? It's something you know today. Like, what is that next step? And a lot of days it's a continuation of what you're already doing. And then some days it's no new information. Like, we got to completely change. And yeah, you just got to be really, I mean, it's tough. Like, you know, I think we've probably missed a couple times where we should have changed course quicker, but it's tough to do it. People have understanding that you don't, right? They're not always great at telling you and describing to you what it is. And so someone may say, like, yeah, let's say we worked at a banana company, right? Me and you were selling bananas. People were like, I don't like bananas. Bananas taste bad. You should sell oranges or whatever. Should you listen to that and be like, okay, customer's always right. Let's go sell oranges. Maybe. But I think you should dig into it a little more. And, you know, you gotta try to figure out, like, okay, what is that core truth there? Because, like, there's so many variables around them being like, I don't like your bananas. So you dig in and be like, okay, what do you not like about the bananas? Well, they're kind of tart. Well, they're kind of tart. Okay, why, like, when are you buying them? And you find out they're buying them green and they didn't know you're supposed to wait to ripen. So they're eating them too early. So I don't think you should always listen. Like, the customers have the answer. They don't always describe it to you. You shouldn't just take them at face value, but, like, every customer has the truth locked somewhere within them. You got to just figure out how to get it out. Because, like, sometimes that core truth is just like, I'm upset about other stuff. I'm just lashing out, you know, especially in, like, consumer software. You get some, like, crazy, crazy comments. Just trying to, like, you know, dig in, figure out what that core thing is. Like, talking to people is always good. Always just try to call them. Anytime I, like, you know, on consumer software, that's easy, right? Like, anytime anyone leaves a comment, always have them leave their phone number, and then I call them and just talk to them for a little bit. Because if you talk to someone, like, on a Zoom or a phone call, you usually get to like what that core truth is. Even if that core truth sometimes is just like, I've had people just be like, yeah, I'm frustrated about other stuff. Like, don't worry about it. I'm just lashing out. 9 times out of 10, especially with, like, really negative feedback, 9 times out of 10, there's other stuff going on. You're a proxy for what they're actually upset about. But then 1 out of 10, there is, like, a really deep truth you have to understand. So you got to, like, dig through all of it to try to find it. It's, like, so valuable. You need to go and try to get it. Yeah, I think negative feedback is such a gift. I think there are a lot of things. I'm sure there's a lot of things that, you know, people think about me and about us. That just, like, we live in a really polite society, so people don't say it. So if someone's going to give you negative feedback, like, that is invaluable. You need to, like, go hunt that down and figure out, like, is that something I should listen to or is it not? You gotta lean into it. I think if you treat it that way, it's like, you know, there's a 10% chance that this negative feedback just told me a really valuable truth. And then there's a 9 out of 10 chance that this negative feedback has nothing to do with me. Then you're really incentivized to go, like, hunt down that truth, and you're like, the pain of someone saying something about you is that much, because it's like, either they're saying something really true you got to listen to, or, like, it literally has nothing to do with you.
But is there a difference between making negative comments about the product or technology versus making negative, versus just not believing in what you're going to do?
Yeah, I think that's probably true for all deep tech. Someone said, like all deep tech is fraud until it's not. And, like, if you look at, like, any great deep tech company, like NVIDIA, SpaceX, Tesla, like, everyone always questions the outcome. It's like, okay, I just can't see electric cars where, like, you're going to put charging stations, like, everywhere. Like, we already have, like, gas stations built out. You're going to, like, produce that many batteries. You're going to produce mass scale rockets for what business? Like, what business is trying to get to space that often? you know, like there's always people who are both like, you know, one, you'll never get the tech to work, and two, like, you'll get it to work, but then like, for what, you know? And that's true sometimes, but a lot of the times it's just, you know, lack of vision. I mean, there's very rare times where you expand the tech tree and there's not an outsized outcome. But I mean, like, people can make arguments that sound really good. So you just gotta, like, we always had like one sheet of paper that wrote down, like, we had all our math on it. It was like, okay, if you ever like, if you ever have someone hit you with like, hey, this isn't worth doing, and they have a good argument, go back to the paper and with their argument and then look back at it and go, okay, like, what assumption did this just disprove that would mean we should not do this thing? And it's, if there's nothing, just keep going. And if there is something, like, let's talk about it. But yeah, I mean, smart people are not always well positioned to, you know, sometimes they just talk, they're not well positioned to like actually dig into something and give a great assessment of it. Especially successful people, I think it's a tough thing. Like, successful, there are really good successful people who are really humble, but then there's successful people who just have an ego. And I think people think that person feels like they're on top of the world and they feel great, but like, honestly, that person is comparing themselves, right? They're making, you know, they want to be the best. And if anyone looks like they're going to threaten their chance of being the best, they're scared of that person. Like, they are like, being on the top is like a deeply insecure place to be if you don't have humility. And so they're, you know, they're looking to push people back down. They want to like stay on top of the mountain.
Is an ego, I mean, sort of like required in building
ego? Like,
yeah.
I firmly believe ego is not helpful. It's bad. I think people conflate confidence and ego. Because you do have to have confidence. You have to you have to have good self-confidence. And I think a good self-confidence sometimes looks like ego. And then I think there's also the success bias of like sometimes you can have a really big ego and kind of make it through tech. But like, I think the success bias is you just had a great thing and that thing was going to be great either way. But if you look at it, like kind of like Uber and WeWork, they had great things. And people really praise them for like that ego. But like in the end of the day, the ego is what got both. They could have gone on to keep doing great. They were both great founders and had great products. Neither of those things were benefited by ego. They're benefited by self-confidence. So like ego it has nothing to do with self. I know a lot of really self-confident people who don't have egos. I think that's wrong. I could be wrong. But like, I think I've seen more people destroyed by ego than helped. And so I think it just should, yeah, it should be avoided at all costs. I think, and like startups are so good at like feeding your ego. Especially if you have like any semblance of success, but, I think it's a trap, you know.
Where did the line between ego and self-confidence converge for what is?
Self-confidence is I will do the things necessary to get X thing, right? Or to get Y thing. And ego is I am me, thus I deserve great thing. I'm better than people. Like it is a way to like rationalize, I think, success in startups. Because sometimes like you hit these scale outcomes and things are really working, and the best explanation is just like I'm that guy. I am it, you know. That's the best explanation. It makes the most sense. Makes you feel good. It also gives you confidence that like that trend will continue, right? Like I don't really know how I got from point A to point B. So I'm just going to assume I've got that magic touch, and that magic touch will get me from B to C. Whereas like self-confidence is like, I figured out how to go from A to B, and I am confident in myself to go from B to C, but that doesn't mean that I don't have to put in a lot of work. I have to be really thoughtful. Like, you know, there's a component of luck to this that can't be ignored. I'm going to do everything I can from go from B to C, But if we start going from back down to A a little bit, that's okay, because we'll keep figuring it out. Whereas like if you have that ego and you get to B, you start going back down to A a little bit, you're going to be like, what? They're like, you know, the universe is conspiring against me. I'm that guy. I should be going to C, but like what's going on around me? I'm going to like start lashing out at people. And like there's something external wrong, because internally, like, I'm that guy. Like, this can't be happening to the guy. So
I call people out. Dude, Adam Draper is the greatest guy who I've seen without an ego. He has a lot of self-confidence.
Sure. Yeah.
He should have an ego, I'll say. He could have an ego, but he has just the right amount of self-confidence and humility. And they, I don't know how he does that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Like, his outcomes show this, right? There are people in VC with an ego, and they go from trend to trend, right? Because they have to look good. They have to continue the, like, I'm great. Whereas Adam is investing in industries so early, way before anyone, right? Like, he's in VR when no one's in VR. And you can't have an ego and do that, because you look dumb, right? Like, you look like Adam is so good. And like, I hope he sees this. Like, he's so good at being comfortable looking dumb. And in the end, he looks like because he is a genius, but he looks like a genius because like he saw the thing early, criticized for it. But he ultimately, he's right. Like, he is able to hold that conviction. Like, you could only do that if you have self-confidence. If you have ego, you're going to jump from trend to trend. You're going to like hide in the shadows the things you failed at, because you want to continue up this, like, you need that external validation that you're great. I think he's a really thoughtful person. He spends a lot of time thinking, and he spends a lot of time self-analyzing and looking at his actions and his life and trying to make it better. I think, you know, that's the skill you have to develop, is like being really good at analyzing yourself and what you're doing. It's tough, but like, he is really good at that. So I gotta imagine it's that. And I think, you know, I think he's just a great guy. I don't know. I would love to know. I'd love to hear from him, like, how he's built, because he's done that for a long time. And he's done that when, like, he's had wins that should have given him an ego. But he does it. I don't know how he does it.
He invests in companies like a legend. I mean, he's looked at sort of, I mean, I looked at the future thing. But you had five demand at other deep play companies. So when they, from people like Adam, people not like Adam, investing. How does that really look like for you? Because these things require a lot of money to build, and the results have a later exit time frame than other needs.
Yeah, I think, you know, it does take a lot of money to build. And I think a lot of people go into startups and they just assume like they're going to have like this great thing and people are going to give them money for it and follow the rules, right? And like, so people are going to tell you like, okay, go do these things and you'll get funding. Those like the real rules are not public, right? No one has a list of the real rules of how VC works. So I think if like you, anytime you want to go, like, it's just like you got to treat VCs like a customer, and you have to treat them really well, right? Like, you kind of have this like bilateral relationship, right? Like, you're also the customer for them, right? But you both have this relationship, and you need to treat each other really well. And you also, like, just like you would in any sales process, any other sales process, you are going to spend a lot of time researching the industry and talking to people about how it works and how they make purchasing decisions and like, you know, how many purchases are they making a year and like what goes into that decision and what helps, and like, walk me through how, you know, you've made other purchases in the past. Like, how did that work? You'll understand the real process of how people are making purchases. And then people go into VC and they're like, well, I'll just follow the rules that I Googled online or that like my mentor told me, and do no research on like how like VC actually works. And VC is something that changes. So like, you know, there's the way that it was working, especially with deep tech when we were raising our pre-seed, is totally different than it is now. Like, I gotta go back and talk to people again and like find out like how is it currently working and like how, like, you know, what do you need to do? So I think like so many people have a disdain. I don't think you can raise money and have a disdain for the asset class. I think, you know, VCs, I don't know what, like, when this happened, but like, when did it become cool to like crap all over VCs? Like, it's an amazing asset class. It's crazy that it exists, right? It's crazy. I think it's one of the most like valuable value creation engines in the world. And we have such a good ecosystem for it. And like, these are people who spend, and people who could like otherwise be really good operators, but they're spending their time kind of voting on what the future looks like, right? And that's hard. And it's super valuable. And I think like, if you don't have a love for it, then why do it, right? Why go raise VC if you don't have a love for the asset class and the people who work in it?
But you talk about your VC down and the difference that you're seeing now, but in detail, how does follow on really working with it? Because in software companies and in regular companies, it's like you need the product, you build the MVP, that's it, and the growth is seriously. I don't think that would work with deep tech, or does it?
Well, I think people got pretty used to things being consistent in ZERP. I don't think there's ever milestones. There shouldn't ever be, right? Like, it's something that is this changing, evolving thing. But for a while, like, you know, IPOs. People had a lot of confidence in IPOs. People had a lot of confidence in long-term growth in software. And so it made kind of like aligning these mile markers with like these named rounds really easy. But it was never true. And like, now you see that, like, everything's way more murky. And so I think you just have to make sure you're having conversations with the people who are both on your cap table and people you're looking to bring onto the cap table. About where, you know, you all collectively think the world's going, and that's kind of like where you should be. End of the day, I think if you look at, there is pretty good precedent for deep tech on kind of like milestone-ish or where you should be. But, you know, always changing. Yeah, I think you just got to talk to the people, you know, who are looking that round about kind of like where you all think that milestone should be.
How do you get VCs or just people in general to align with your worldview?
No one needs to align with your worldview to take a bet on you, right? Especially like in the early rounds. You know, it's kind of like, okay, one, if this works, will it be as big as they say it will be? That's kind of what you really got to align on. And it's like in deep tech, like that's easier than software. I think like software, it's harder to discern, like, you know, will Instagram be around in 10 years? The photo editing app? I don't know. Like, you know, it was a lot harder to like discern that versus like, okay, if you make like this breakthrough tech and you reach scale mass production, and like, it's so much harder to compete with it. So like, you'll probably be around for a long time. And like, is this person someone who will continue to innovate with them? Yeah, they're going to like reach sales size outcome. So I think that's what you got to align on. And then it's like, can you get there? That's really just an assessment of like people individually. I used to not think, I used to think like, no, I think like most everyone can probably get there. Like, it's tough to tell. But now, like, after seeing, you know, Four years of data on like the type of people who kind of make it happen and the people who did, it's pretty, you can kind of tell who that person is like right away talking to them. So I gotta imagine like VCs too have a pretty good pattern recognition for like what it takes to do that. So I don't think anyone needs to align with your worldview. And a lot of times I think the best VCs don't. The best VCs are making invested in someone and think that they see the world wrong. But like, on the off chance they don't, they're with them.
In the 4 years of data that you have, what is your pattern recognition looking for when dialing people for?
Yeah, I think like really, really, really easily. There are like two types of people. There's people who like hit a wall and they turn around and they go the other way, like Roomba, right? they're like Roomba people. They hit a wall. They're like, okay, I'm gonna go find there's a path in here somewhere. And then there are people who hit a wall, and the first thing they do is they run really fast and throw their shoulder into it just to see, right? Like, just to see, okay, does this wall actually, is it real? Can I just run through it, you know? And then the second thing they do is they, you know, try to look for a way over it. And there are times where the Roomba person gets through the maze faster, right? Like, there's times where, like, not going through a wall is the right call. But people with a default run through the wall are way more likely to have the outsized outcome than people who go around, because, like, those people are looking for a path, right? And there's not much value creation in the path. Like, that path is a path for a reason, that someone has worn that path. When you run through a wall, there are so many rules in our society that are not real, but they feel real. They feel like scientific fact, but they're not. And when you try to run through that wall, sometimes you realize, like, oh, it's cardboard. Just no one bothered to try to run through it. And then here I am, I've got like this way faster path. And those people are just like way more likely to succeed than not. Because it's like the mental game of startups is really hard. If you have default action, then like, yeah, you're kind of a bull in a china shop, but like eventually you'll hit a wall, you'll break through, right? And like that, I don't even know if intelligence even matters there. I think it's helpful. I think, you know, you're kind of looking for that unicorn that is both intelligent and will run through those walls. But end of the day, if you just run through the walls, that's 90% of it. Then I think long-term outcome requires someone with high rationality and high empathy, which is a tough, like, combo to have. Because I've seen people with really high empathy only really struggle with managing teams. They're too empathetic, right? They're too aware of, not too aware, but care too much about people's feelings. And so when things get tough, struggle to make that call. People who high rationality and empathy are just burning and churning people, and they can't, you know, get the right people together. You need longevity in a business to be good. So I think it's that high curiosity. You don't want to, I've seen people, like, it's the ego thing again. Like, I've seen people run through that first wall and everyone claps and cheers, and then they stay there because, like, oh, in this position people cheer for me, so I'm here, like, you know, I've done it. And then they, like, you know, anytime people look at them, they're like, look, I ran through the wall. I'm the guy who ran through the wall. Yeah, Who Moved My Cheese is a great, like, better analogy than I'm making here, but that's a great book. But yeah, you need high curiosity and kind of, like, focus on your own thing. And I think in that way, like, I'm thinking of the people that I know who are like that. I think Ben and Tristan from Reflect Orbital are exactly that. They're, you know, and they also are super smart. So, like, they're kind of the unicorn there. But anything else, like, if you're also good at design, which I'm not, that's super helpful. I wish I was. Really tough to bring on someone good at design. Kind of got to be inherent. Really helpful. Storytelling. I think you have to be a good storyteller. Almost a non-negotiable. If you're not, you have to get someone right next to you who is. You can't buy that. No one's going to help you tell the story. Like, no one can. If you're trying to, like, if someone's sitting there and they, like, trying to nail in a nail, right? And they're punching it. They're punching the nail in. And you go and you make a hammer and you just put it with the other tools. You're like, boom. That's a hammer. It's for hitting nails. But, like, the person punching the nail is going to turn over. They'll see the tool and they'll use it to hit the tool. Because, like, an engineer is a good engineer because they see the world as a set of problems. And they think everyone else sees it as a set of problems. So they think when they encounter a problem, they're going to look around for the best tool to use because that's what an engineer does, right? They look around for the best tool to use. So they're like, okay, marketing is for trying to convince someone that a bad tool is a good tool. That's how I see marketing. But the reality is that marketing is helping people identify that there is a problem and there's a tool to solve it. And that's good, right? It's like putting the hammer on the wall with all the tools and then also making a sign that says, this is for hitting nails. Use this to hit nails. That way, when the person looks around, they're like, oh, to hit nails. Oh, this thing. look at this. This rocks. So I think you got to love marketing and you got to love sales for what it is. I think that gets in the way of a lot of engineers who think it's bad. I think that's it. I think you like being a good storyteller, high empathy, high rationality, curiosity, and then default action. Like default, I'm going to run through this wall instead of going around it.
One last reason that when into startup VC, then only thing coding since I was like 11. What do you think is one fact that will blow 11-year-old me?
That you can just do things. And if it makes sense, you should do that thing. Even if you've never seen someone do that thing before, and it almost always works. Steve Jobs never got if I remember this right, he never got a license plate. Yeah, he would just like keep getting a new car, and then never had to have a license. And that worked. Like those kind of things always work. You can just do whatever you want as long as it's like there's not a law against it, or like you're not breaking physics. You can literally do anything. And then you start to forget that as you get older, but like where you start to think like, oh, well, if you could do this thing, someone would have already done it because I've never seen this before, which is never true. There are so many things that are just low hanging fruit that like we don't do for like, you know, societal or like we've created all these rules. Yeah. So you can do whatever you want.
Great. But that new prepared of my mind, and I think this will be incredible. I want to take the time out for this, and I'll let you go now. I think that's it from my side. I think.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This was so fun. I really appreciate it. It was great to meet you.